Welcome, welcome to the show, Julia Sont of The Final Frontier. Oh my goodness, I love this conversation we're going to have about death. Death is kind of a spooky thing to a lot of people, but not to you, is it?
Not anymore, no, for sure.
Well, tell us a little bit about the research that you've done in order to comprehend what death really could mean as a portal, as a, you called it a frontier, to what?
Right, right, yeah, as a, or a land. Most of what I've written about comes from my own experience and analysis of my own experience, which I then matched up with a lot of research. Basically, I just look for provocation wherever I can, you know, to make me think.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also done, I worked as past life therapist, a regression therapist for a long time. So I had that view as well, the view of mediumship and the research view. I also have had a near-death experience. So I've got most of the cards in place. But I couldn't say that I know what the afterlife is, and I don't think any of us does.
Right. But there was something I read on one part of your website, which was something that made me just really chuckle. You said, is there a before life, and is there before birth, and is there an afterlife? And
right.
It made me think that there's just existence beyond the third dimension. You see what I mean? I found that the
absolutely
applied a tremendous dynamic.
Yeah, you know, what are these out of body experiencers doing? And
exactly.
there's a big difference between those who enter out of body states through lucid dreaming and those who don't, who enter it consciously. They get different kinds of information and different kinds of experiences. Where does that come into the mix? These are all non-physical states.
So where does it come into the mix?
That's
pop,
right.
Do you
yes.
pop in and out at will?
I think we have to just understand the afterlife as a non-local reality where anything goes. They talk about consensus realities, especially old out-of-body experiences talk about consensus realities. I haven't seen an awful lot of that with mediumship. What I usually see are people who are pretty much on their own or with certain select friends. They have sometimes they go into a certain kind of a communal situation if they're doing something like Michael, this one dear friend of mine, had a restaurant and was trying to help these young suicide kids.
Okay. And
where they
he's
would
the
all
medium, was he?
No, he's dead.
Oh, okay.
Right, and this is one of the things that he was doing in the afterlife. He was a restaurateur in life, and he always wanted to do something like that, you know, have a special restaurant for troubled young men. And that's what he was doing in the afterlife. But I've seen others do research, or others actually become music,
oh, really?
Or become electrical
that's
realities.
So you mean if you could imagine it, it's possible that they're involved in something like that.
That's right. And then the other thing is, too, is that we have this idea of the afterlife being a place where all the dead go.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about that either anymore. I think that there might be a lot of interaction with, I don't know what word to use here, consciousness personalities who never really incarnated.
Oh, I see. All right. So those are would we call those simplistically angels, or would you just say consciousness, meaning there's so
yeah,
much wisdom out there that doesn't have to embody, right?
Right, exactly.
Do you think there's
and
a
if you think about it, there is probably a great deal of your own oversoul that's never incarnated and never will, but is exploring in different types of realities. Hmm?
I'm not sure if I said this last time, but one time when my husband, he was dying, he had a brain hemorrhage, and I was driving home, and I kept asking his higher self, is he going to make it through? And always, he would show himself up as if he was sitting with his legs crossed in a contemplative pose, and he'd say, I haven't decided yet. And then one day I was driving home from the hospital in the car, and he showed up as if he were a ghost. And I knew he was still alive. And that, to me, you're talking about the oversoul or the higher soul and so on. I'm going, that to me was evident, my first real specific evidence of somebody being able to function independently of their physical.
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, we all do anyway when we're sleeping. But I've come across so many coma patients who are fully active in what we're now calling the afterlife, or even people with Alzheimer's. It's as though their bodies are on some sort of remote control system. So, yes, that happens a lot. It's not, you know, this is what I'm going to be talking about this at the afterlife conference. I'm sure people are going to be very angry, but death really is not about the body. It doesn't really.
What is it about?
It's about a shift in consciousness. It's about where the direction consciousness is going, whether it's going into physical reality or it's leaving it, or if it's focused in physical reality in this particular plane that we know, or it's turned its focus away. And that focus starts to leave very often in old age well before a person dies, which is one of the reasons why dementia comes in. But it can leave at any time, whether or not the body is dead.
Hmm.
And it gets really freaky when you start looking hard at the incarnation evidence that we have collected by now, especially from these researchers at the University of Virginia, Jim Tucker, who took over Ian Stevenson after his death, Ian Stevenson's position. And when you really, really start to read what they're doing with children's memories, they have no concept of what's going on, these researchers. But as a medium, I can fill in the blanks.
And they can't
really
have
people,
a concept because they don't have the linear ways of proving what they're trying to prove, right?
No, yes, they do. They can prove children with accuracy rates of 98%. That's enormous. I mean, nobody has accuracy rates of one's own childhood, let alone the life before.
So you're saying little kids can actually remember specifically other lives?
Well, that's true, but this type of accuracy comes from a different situation. And this is the main focus of my paper for the conference, in that they don't die. They just jump from one body to another. These children with these spectacular memories have an interim period of 16 months. Now, I know that because as a medium, I see people routinely who've died in shock or killed themselves or whatever who are trying to come right back.
Hmm.
And they do. So it's the same personality, not one that's been recycled through so-called afterlife.
Do we all
keep it's not about the body.
Do we all keep our own personality?
Not when we reincarnate normally, no.
Okay, so that's just when you're driven to hop in and out, is that right?
It's when you've never made that shift in consciousness. You've never changed your focus. You've never let go. And so you come back and your body still has the marks of whatever killed you, and you have this incredible, spectacular memory. Usually they're traumatic deaths. Almost always, not usually. And that tells us a lot. You see, the point that I'm making is this disconnect of what consciousness does with or without the assistance of the body. It really is free of it.
So how does that help in terms of healing? It sounds to me like, you know, we could do a lot of healing on ourselves if we were really facile with that, if we were able to work with that.
Absolutely. Sure, if you understood the impact that consciousness can have on a body, for instance. If you look at, there are not many, but there are some studies on multiple personalities.
Right.
Because there are not many true multiple personalities out there, which are probably more than one soul in the same body. Not the other way around. But more than one soul in the same body, in the same way that you can have more than one reincarnation alive at the same time.
You can?
Oh, yes. I have it. Lots of people do. So it's consciousness can split itself up any way it wants to in terms of the body. But if you look at some of the research that's been done on multiple personalities, you see that when the personality shifts, a given sickness like diabetes is gone in the other personality. That's saying something.
Yeah, and the eye color changes, right?
Yeah. And it's fascinating, and it's because our body's so-called matter is created in the tiniest possible millionths of a second, over and over and over again in beats, in and out from sort of virtual reality or other realities. Same atoms are used, the same molecules are used for adjacent realities. It comes in and out, in and out, in and out. The impression that we have, of course, is that it's solid.
Nothing solid.
So if we really understood that we're only here 50% of the time, and when we are in this disappearance act, we can come back substantially different, as people do after near-death experiences, as people do when they're switching personalities.
Well, so what are we all trying to do? Just gain experience? Is there kind of any kind of progression involved in these changes that we would will our consciousness to go through?
Well, yes, the idea is to gain experience. The idea is always this fulfillment, this self-fulfillment, this drive, which most people feel, yeah. You know? Drive to have a child, a baby's drive to walk, to grow up. These are the basic things that we're doing in this particular plane.
Right.
It's exploration, it's creativity. And lots of people like to call all of that learning, which I think puts it in a pretty dark corner. I don't particularly like the idea of learning and progressing in an evolutionary mode. I don't like any of that. I like the idea of expansion of awareness, expansion of your creative abilities, your expansion of anything you can name, more or less. You incorporate more and more and more and become, therefore, more godlike.
So tell me this. I know you've done lots of research on lots of different things. So what about groups of people, for example, the souls that all went down in 9/11, you know, when you've got a group of beings.
Yeah.
What happens?
Agreement, yeah.
Absolutely,
they're agreement.
Is it individual, like some will come back immediately because they're holding on to this plane? Some are aware that they're going to keep launching creatively? And, you know, what would you say about a group?
I would say yes to both the things you just said. I think that almost anything goes. You know, some people will participate in something like September 11th for their own reasons and for mass reasons. Okay? And some people will die and not adjust. And some people will die and realize what they, you know, that they have fulfilled whatever that life plan was. So it doesn't mean that when you die that you have instant awareness, because a lot of people will be in denial or they'll still stay in the horror of something or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Anything can happen.
Or stunned or completely.
Yeah, exactly.
Unaware.
A lot of it is about shock. And when a person stays in shock after the physical body is dead, they can make a lot of mistakes.
Mm. So talk about people. I'm fascinated by the number of spirits that I see, for example, in readings, and I know you're way beyond me on that level. But I have some questions of you. Like, do they come because they want, so many of them come to my readings because they want to unhook something left behind with someone and they wanted to free themselves and the other person. You see what I mean?
There sure.
To be, have you got something to say about that or a broad?
Yeah, I think reconciliation is a gigantic drive. And for the deceased to be reaching us and for us to be reaching them. And you see, too, often in mediumship, I'm sure you've come across this a lot, where they need help. For instance, they can't find somebody, or they want to reach somebody who's alive, or they can't find somebody who's already dead. And so sometimes I end up trying to help them connect with a person who's gotten lost in a certain way or doesn't want to meet them, and then we have a little bit more of a problem. But still, the effects of this kind of work can actually change a whole family constellation.
Yeah, I think it's really healing, isn't it?
Yes, for everybody, because these things emanate out in dream states and unconscious states to every family member, and it shifts things. Now, one of the reasons why I'm so strong about getting people to do their own mediumship, since everyone can, is just telepathy, and we couldn't have a body without telepathy. It wouldn't stay together. This is all done with telepathy, cell to cell, cell to organ, blah, blah, blah. One of the reasons why I am so insistent on this is because when you do meet people on the other side, say a parent, you had difficulty with your mother, and if she died well, she probably will have changed substantially. And then you see who she is without the fear. And that is breathtaking. You see who she really is.
Inner child, can it heal that inner child?
Yes, because you've then become a parent of somebody, the child of somebody substantially different.
Right.
And your self-identity starts to shift. That's certainly what happened to me.
Wow, isn't that exciting? Yeah, I notice people changing right before my very eyes when we're speaking across the veil like that. Is there a veil? What does that mean, across the veil?
These old terms. I don't know. We have a paucity of terminology that's suitable for this stuff. And I've always said that, you know, in 100 years from now, we'll have several hundred words for consciousness.
I know, it's funny because you used the word matter a while back, and I thought, isn't that interesting? Because that blocks all these other things because they don't matter. You know, that's how the society has been, right, to a degree.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of interesting. So tell me, Julia, what do you think of the shift and the change in human consciousness on the planet? Do you think in the afterlife, if that's what it's called, I'm being cheeky now, do you think that spirit beings are helping with that in a huge way, or do you think that we are all contracted at some level to be a part of this time?
Yes, I am certainly, we have to do this. I mean, it's a survival question. But, you know, Americans are very self-absorbed because a lot of this is not really happening in most other countries.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You mean a lot of the destruction or a lot of the spirits?
No, the afterlife stuff. And it hasn't really taken hold in most other countries. It's become a real industry in the United States by now.
Yeah.
But let me just say
I think it has
a lot to do with, first of all, we are very, very savvy about how to have a child.
Okay.
You know, the prenatal and the birthing and all that kind of stuff has changed enormously. That alone, and the support parents give to children, and the potential that a child has to do things at a very young age we didn't have when we were kids, you and I.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had balls and once in a while television, and that was it. But and dolls, you know, which is great for the imagination, but still it has certain kinds of limitations. Now, these children and ourselves are all constantly absorbing electrical impulses or electronic impulses. We're absorbing them all the time.
That's true.
And that is what expands perception. Because the more of these electronic impulses that you can read, let's say, the more perception you have that becomes conscious.
Huh.
Because all of this takes place on an electrical level. All of this is about an electronic transmission or materialization.
So what do you?
So I think that technology is probably the biggest of all pushers, and it's, you know, as most things, art takes the lead, and it is our art. Technology is our art. And just thinking of the idea of the internet and collapsed space. The telephone and disembodied voices. I mean, technology has prepared us emotionally, psychologically, and even physically for these new kinds of experiences.
Yeah, I think of the cell phone in our body cells and how it's just a huge metaphor, a huge training wheels, yeah?
Exactly.
Well, this is really exciting. So do you think, this is going back to the question about consciousness in collectives. So do you think politically that we can move faster because of our rapport with beings on the other plane? I mean, to heal the planet, to change
our political system. I don't think they interfere too much. I think that's the point of free will.
Really?
I don't think there's I don't think there's anybody up there who's pushing us in a certain direction, no.
And there's
you have inspiration, you have guidance, you have all these sorts of things, but I don't think there are any masterminds pushing the human race in a certain direction.
Hmm. It's just experience.
This is all free will. It has to rest on our own experience or it can't happen. They are not manifesting here and they're not possessing us to manifest. We're doing the manifestation.
Hmm. But I get, yeah, so you don't think that, let's talk about then contracts between souls. For example, we already talked about the 9/11 people. Or what about, I don't know, I'm thinking of group consciousness. Is there a lot of that on a soul level that we're seeing acting out on this plane and then we can get some help from spirit beings?
Yeah, there are waves of this, absolutely. Waves of very energetic souls that come in at the same time.
Is that what's going
absolutely.
On now, do you think?
Yeah, I do. At least in the Western world. The Roman period and the lag afterwards, for instance, it's just like all these energetic souls disappeared for a while.
So do you
know,
think some of
then we went into the Dark Ages, the so-called Dark Ages. Yeah, it comes in beats. It's you know, civilizations, world epics, they have their lives and deaths too, yeah?
Mm-hmm. I know, it's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Mm.
I think we're redoing the 60s in a certain way. I kind of watch people, and it looks like there's something moving through that reminds me a bit of that time.
Well, the
60s
were
that?
Crucial. They were crucial.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite amazing to have been in it, don't you think?
Oh,
I know a lot of X-generation kids or young adults who are jealous of our having been in the forefront of those kinds of changes then. But it was very anti-technology.
I guess it was, although technology was in a different place at the time. I think there's young people making a big difference now. And I watch them. They're really, really sensitive, and they're a little less violent, I guess. But they all know the old 60s music. They all know all the lyrics, the ones I meet anyway. And I'm going, wow. They're trying to make a difference, I find.
Yeah.
All right, so you said everyone can be their own medium. How do you teach people to be a medium?
Well, I do have something posted on my website, just a few principles they can use. And it's really, it's just a matter of focus and deep listening. You know, it's just a matter of being still and focusing. And desire is extremely important, too. It can't be something that's sort of idle unless you're very practiced.
Hmm.
Yeah, then possibly you can do it. But what really brings them in is need. And that's what makes a psychic good, is the other person's need. So on any of these levels, in need and intention are the operating factors.
You also are a historian for Mesopotamian history. Is there a lot about mediumship and intuitive work and that healing work and so on from those times?
Excuse me. Well, the healing stuff is a little weird. I mean, because they had the same idea that you see arising in the New Testament. Anything that was wrong with you was generally understood as being, excuse me,
the
as being disfavor of the gods. Of a god. There was no concept of sin in Mesopotamia. It was just whether you didn't do the right thing by a deity, a male or female deity, you didn't honor them enough or whatever. And certainly they had a lot of household shrines, and there was a lot of interaction with the dead, huge amounts of incantations and purification rituals and things of that sort. Some of them are hysterically funny. Some of them are for sexual potency, for instance. There's a whole giant volume out on that. But they lived this way. The unseen was a deep part of their lives, and not all of it was unseen. In Sumerian, which was the first known written language, they had a word called Hili, which really was the word for aura. It was a brilliant light that emanated around certain people and objects. I think everyone had, to some degree, Hili. And this word transferred into later languages, too. So they were very aware of this. They have many different components of consciousness, too, that we don't have, that are similar to the Egyptian ones. So they recognized a lot more activity on non-physical levels. The Jews had nothing. Nothing.
No non-physical?
Nothing, no.
Wow, isn't that interesting?
Yes, this is where all the problems really started. It's just this breakup and the development of this of the Yahweh or Jehovah cult. Under King Josiah, the afterlife was more or less stamped out. In fact, the people who controlled the temple, even in the time of Jesus, officially did not believe in survival after death. The Pharisees weren't sure. When they talk about heaven in the Bible, they mean it in the same way that Greeks talked about Mount Olympus, where the gods lived. People don't live there.
Is that a specific goal, physical goal, is it?
Yeah, and that's exactly what happens with apocalypticism. Apocalypticism is coming back to life through your body. That's your eternity.
So that's when heaven is right here. What is that biblical quote? The kingdom of heaven is within. Is that?
Yeah.
I think that kind of thought runs through all religions in a way, even the Bhagavad Gita.
It
right?
does, but the kingdom of heaven is the kingdom of God, and Yahweh was not a god of the underworld. And that's exactly what they didn't want, because Baal, the Canaanite god, who was the most powerful of them, was an underworld god. And also, the dead were referred to as Elohim, which means divinities or gods, and you could not have any other, you could not pay respects to any other god. It is not as though in ancient Judaism they disbelieved in other gods. The point was that you only paid obedience to one. This was a cult that formed during the same time monarchy formed in Jerusalem. And they were modeled, this cult was modeled on monarchies, where there was this one king god, and that's it. So you could no longer, by threat of death by stoning, you could no longer communicate with the dead.
Oh, wow.
It was knocked out, and mourning rites were curtailed. It was terrible. And basically, at this time, the god Yahweh, this local god, he was a Jerusalem god, abandoned and closed up the afterlife.
Wow!
So it creates a lot of confusion.
Remember when they cut out all the reincarnation and that sort of thing out of Catholicism?
Well, it wasn't deeply entrenched, but there were people who did believe in it. And, yeah, they did. They got rid of that. They got rid of a lot.
Yeah. Through history, it's stuff that would maybe empower people that gets cut out, I think. Eh?
Yeah.
Well,
so that would disempower an institution gets cut out.
That's right. If the people get too powerful, they won't sign up. They won't like
right.
us.
Right.
That's really exciting. All right, so do you have any advice for people about dealing with, like, I feel this, that there's more and more connection with the other side, whatever that means, lately, and I think it's really functional to help a lot of us get to be more whole. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, 100%. And it's just the beginning, you know. If we can start doing this and get some real idea, a deep-seated idea of what we are as immortal beings, not after we die, but now when we're in the body, this planet will change. And to get rid of this fear of death, which is, you know, Veronica, I feel that that's the big problem in our world.
In our whole world, I know. That's the reason we have wars, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the reason we have most of the junk we have. I mean, it's even behind greed, let alone the spiritual industry, which also has huge amounts of death fear.
Well, and before I end this, because I know you don't have much time left, what do you know about the death cafes? Because I think that's a pretty interesting subject.
I think it's great. They're not, as far as I know, I think they started in France, probably in a very different way from the way they are
apparently
in the
Holland,
United States.
Yeah.
No. But anyway, there's no real leadership in these things. That's the idea. Nobody wants leadership. So it's just a discussion, a place to come and discuss the undiscussable. And that's terrific. I have never been to one.
I haven't.
Is there one in Bellingham?
Researching. We do. Right where you're going to be giving your workshop in June, there's also a death cafe in that particular church.
Hmm.
What do you think of that?
Well, maybe I'll stop in.
Yeah, I just found out about all this before I called you, actually.
Yeah. Well, my impression is that they don't want, you know, some expert-type person showing up for this sort of thing, but...
Oh, I don't know. I think that we should probably, Julia, we'll talk to people at home about this, but we should set up a little online conference sometimes and get people to call in about it. What do you think?
Great idea. Really is. You know, Veronica, the problem is how much pain there is around this.
Yeah, I know. Like it's easy to say.
Huge amounts of pain. And, you know, I work with a lot of mothers who've lost their children, especially through suicide, and the triumphant ones are the ones who pull through with the communication. And then their lives change entirely, and they go into this ecstatic journey of discovering non-physical dimensions and communication, and it's wonderful. But not all of them can do that. They're not inspired to do that. Everyone can. There's no reason they can't, other than psychological or emotional reasons. It's this pain is so awful. It's so deep.
I know. Have you experienced
it
yourself?
Grief is important, but we put too much into grief now. We put too many things, such as helplessness and fear and abandonment, and a lot of things that don't belong to grief, which makes grief possessiveness. These things make grief into something grief really is not.
Mm-hmm. That's a big study in itself, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Needs liberating, but more than anything, it's just to get people away from anything but death kind of mentality. Medical industry, hospice, nursing, all of these places where we need to have much more understanding of the magic of death, and that being in the body, life is not always superior to everything else by any means, because we're not dying that well. You know, if we were easier about this, if we knew more, we would die better, and we would do better on the other side.
Well, there are people that believe very much in preparing for death, like you prepare for a wedding, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you're doing great work, Julia, and I'm so hoping I'll be able to track you down when you're over here on the West Coast.
Well, I hope so, too. I'm hoping to meet you one of these days, as you know.
I'd love that. You're going to be in Portland, and you're going to be in Bellingham. And so I'll
and big in Minneapolis. Huge amount of work there.
Really? Isn't that wonderful? Is that kind of indicating a sort of a soul gathering there?
Yeah. There's the Minneapolis crowd. It's this place called Spirit United. And the person who's their head reverend. He's very, you know, not any sort of typical reverend, not particularly Christian. Is a very old friend of mine.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and being there is what it's all about for me, because these are people who are so genuine and they're so committed to their community. It's a whole different thing in Minneapolis than it is in the West Coast. There's so much of it in the West Coast. But there in Minneapolis, you really see why we do this sort of stuff, you know?
Oh, really? Because they really get into the whole death thing and beyond?
Well, they need it, especially in Minneapolis in the winter. The whole death threat is very heavy.
Wow. Oh, this is very exciting. So I am sorry we started this late, but I've really appreciated the time with you. And I really honor you.
Like, I always love to have a little chat with you.
We'll do it again, Julia. And thank you.
We will.
Everybody to check out your website. And your book is The Final Frontier, right? And it has...
The Last Frontier.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Julia Asante, The Last Frontier.
The Last Frontier. So you have a website for that, and you have a website, Julia Asante?
Asante.com,
right?
Yeah, J-U-L-I-A-A-S-S as in Sam, A-N as in Nancy, T-E.com, JuliaAsante.com.
And I want to say you have some wonderful things written up on your website that would help people kind of really enjoy a lot of your special learning and teachings. It's wonderful.
Thank you. And I always respond to people almost immediately.
Wonderful.
Anybody who writes me through the website or on my website, I respond. So anyone who wants to do that, they will get me, not a secretary. I don't have the money for such things.
But you're also collecting personal stories from people around the subject of death and so on, aren't you?
Yeah, but they are personal, and most of them come directly to my email, and I don't post them. Once in a while, I ask for permission to post. But if people write on the site itself in a response to something, then it'll be public.
Okay, but I do think that some people just need to tell somebody like you who's so wise.
Sure.
They
want to know if it's real.
Yeah, exactly. And we know.
You know,
it
that's
is.
Usually what they want to know. Or a lot of people just don't know what to do with the feelings they have or the experiences they have.
Well, I'd like to open the subject one of these days when we're talking about grief and how you think it's been complicated in our society. I think that's very interesting. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, darling. Thank you so much for spending time.
All right. Till the next time, Veronica. Thanks for inviting me.
Bless your heart.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.